NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Cruz.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots in their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
Here we are again. Unfortunately, Greg is off, and so it's you and I, and we have a couple of interesting little subjects to talk about today. Why don't we just get right into it?
Well, before we get right into it, I want to say a little bit something special here about our sponsors. The mission of the Flight Safety Detectives is simple: to dig deep, to bring you the stories, lessons, and sometimes the hard truths that make aviation safer for everyone. Because this work matters to us and to others around the world, we put in the hours and energy to bring you insights you won't hear anywhere else. And we strive to keep the conversation clear, honest, and independent. That's why we're seeking sponsors who share our commitment to this mission. If your company is connected to aviation, whether that's training, technology, or services that help aviation professionals, we'd love to partner with you. When you sponsor the show, you're not just putting your name in front of our audience of engaged, safety-conscious listeners. You're supporting the work that helps keep aviation safer worldwide. To learn how to sponsor Flight Safety Detectives, email us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll work with you to make sure your message really lands. And now, back to the show.
Those were all TV programs. Now, back to the show. A lot of our audience probably never heard that.
Well, both of us are, let's just say that we're both Medicare eligible, and we remember television when there was only three channels. So, yeah, there's a lot of old commercials we might refer to that you folks out there will say, what the heck are they talking about? But I digress. Today's show, we're going to do something a little bit different. You know, for a long time, just about every show, we start by saying, hey, we really listen to the listener questions. We'd like to hear yours. And today, we actually have those questions. And we're taking this from one of our recent shows, episode 288, which was called Strange High-Altitude Encounters Get Stranger. And we had a couple of questions. And for future reference, for those of you who love our videos and watch them, please put your comments in there. Now, if you don't have an actual question in your comments, we might do what we did for this show. There was a very good comment, which I think had a real good question inside of it, and that's the question we're asking. And this was from Dealer Crab R 9425. We said, just like cops have to wear cameras, planes should be required to have cameras. Public transportation like trains, buses, and ships all have cameras. And the question I saw inside of that was, should planes have cameras like police and public transportation?
I can tell you, Todd, while I was with the NTSB, I actually was an advocate for cameras, and some of my pilot friends were not happy when I said that, but for commercial airplanes, and I'm talking now about around the year 2000, plus or minus a little bit, and at that time we had a lot of airplanes that were analog, meaning round gauges, very hard to collect the data, and we were having accidents that we just had voids because the flight data recorders were not there. Many of them only had 11 parameters back in the middle 90s. So that was a problem. And we failed. The NTSB failed to get any traction to get the cameras put in the airplanes. That's just sort of been languishing there. But what has happened in the interim is that our airplanes have become digital machines more and more. Today, they're just virtually 100% digital. And it's so much easier to get all the information you want from a digital data bus than it was from all the different systems. You know, one of the things that we were successful in getting in the mid-90s on airplanes, on the older airplanes, was when you push the rudder pedal down in the cockpit, that's recorded. Well, now we have the actual input on the tail is also recorded. So we can say the pilot wanted full right rudder, and the rudder did move full right rudder. We did have some improvements, but we never got to the cameras. But now with the digital airplanes, it's so easy to pick it up. And that's why most airplanes at a minimum today, commercial airplanes, you know, the 787, the 777, all of them, they all have at least 1,000 parameters in them. The Airbus A380, I was told years ago, had 1,800 parameters in it because it's just so easy to pick them up. So the need for those big, robust video cameras that we originally wanted in these airplanes doesn't exist any longer. And I suspect that as we get further along, the recorders are going to pick up even more data and more information from the actual activity in the cockpit that we don't have today. I will say one thing to everybody. The recent Air India crash, where we had all the controversy going on around it, I'm told that both of those fuel shutoff switches had their positions recorded. We know the exact time that somebody, when the assumption today is the captain, turned them off, turned number one off, and then turned number two off. And then after the comment from the flying pilot, the first officer, they did it again. Whoever did it, again, the assumption is the captain, turned the number one back on and then turned number two back on. So those switch positions are recorded. So as time goes on, we may end up having every single switch position recorded in the cockpit. I have no idea where this is going, but it's become so easy to record this information. I think we're going to have every action in the cockpit recorded. So it's going to be less and less need for the video recorder. You know, the public transportation, the trains that do have the recorders, and they don't all have them. But those that do, there's no other recorder in there. So that's the reason for their pushing on it, and they don't have the wherewithal to push back on public entities like that. So if you work for a public entity and the company requires recorders, you either come in and live with it or you find another job. Different industries have different needs. But I think that in aviation, I think we've improved ourselves to the point where video recorders in the cockpit less. Now, there are some interesting pieces going, additional pieces to that. Many of the airplanes today have a video recorder in the cabin, a couple of them. And one is right by the cockpit door, so you can see what's going on in the cabin behind the cockpit door. And sometimes there's another one further back in the airplane so you can see what the passengers are doing. And those are recorded in some cases. I don't know that there's none that are not recorded, but I'm sure there are. So we are moving further and further along and more video evidence, if you will, for what goes on inside an airplane. But I think we've sort of eliminated the need for it in the cockpit.
And a little bit of background on why that viewer asked that question. And once again, thank you for the question. This was a situation where there was a 767 traveling at night, 34,000 feet, cruising altitude. And for roughly an hour, there were a reported 25 different drones, they described them as drones, that were following the aircraft, four of which were in close proximity to the aircraft, sort of flying in a loose formation for an entire hour. And the FAA documentation we got from that said that these drones, they call them UAS, unmanned aircraft systems, which is the FAA term, were coming from all directions. Well, even if you had a camera in the cockpit, that was recording, let's say, the cockpit switch location and looking out the front windows. That's only a very, very small portion of the sky. The pilots from their seats could look left, could look right, could tilt their heads and whatnot and see a fairly large patch of the sky. But if you have a fixed camera looking forward, it has a very, very narrow field of view. And more than likely, that camera would be optimized to render a good picture of the inside of the cockpit, the switches, switch positions, that sort of thing. And if it saw anything outside, it might be some random looking lights flying around. It would have very little benefit to understanding what exactly was flying around that aircraft. And a more practical reason is that, let's say tomorrow, the FAA or any other entity around the world says, we want these aircraft to have cameras in them. How do you roll it out? It's unlikely it'll be like armored cockpit doors back after 9/11, where there was like an immediate emergency rule, and it was very, very quickly done and implemented as fast as possible on all aircraft. More than likely would follow the pattern seen when there are improvements, evolutionary improvements in the aircraft. The first requirement might be if you're a newly designed aircraft, you have to have this change in it. And they might say for older aircraft, we'll cut you a little bit of slack. Maybe you have to do it when you have a major maintenance check, what's called a D-check, which happens, like every 5 to 7 years for an aircraft. Maybe it's something that is applied through some other means. So it could be a generation or more before every aircraft has that. Meanwhile, like John was saying, the number of parameters you're getting from cockpit voice recorders and flight data recorders now is tremendous, well over 1,000. Switch positions, etc., sound from the microphones, you can figure out other things, such as sounds from the cockpit that might indicate what equipment might have been working outside or not working outside. So the extra benefit of putting video on top of all that is minimal. And the two cases you talk about where some airlines have the cabin cameras and the camera on the cockpit door, that wasn't required by the appropriate authorities like the FAA. That's something the airline did on their own. Now, they could do that because they wouldn't have pushback. But, John, could you imagine if an airline tomorrow wanted to observe their workers in the cockpit and said, you know what, we're going to have a company policy where we have a cockpit camera. We're using the same technology we use in the cabin, except we're going to turn it around and put it on the backs of you pilots there. How much pushback would, I don't know, pilot unions give against this sort of thing?
Well, the pilot unions would be very, very much opposed to that. But there are some corporate airplanes that do have just that. Right? So they do record what their pilots are doing. They are in a minority. There's not very many of them, admittedly. But there are some up there that record the actions in the cockpit. So it's all over the place, essentially. All over the place.
Now, there were two good questions from this episode. And, John, I'll let you read the second question.
Okay, so Paul sent us in a question, and it's I've heard this one multiple times myself. And then, why isn't the elephant in the room being called what it probably is, a UFO? Right? And recently we see more public officials willing to call it UFOs. But boy, for years and years, they swept that under the rug. And we come up with new terms for them, often today. But there is a phenomenon going out there that we can't answer. There are things that are happening that we cannot answer. So we have to, and the government is, I know, working for the government as long as I did, that they don't like to say they don't know. But the truth is, there's a lot of things that happen that we just don't know what it is. And there's so many variables in it. You know, what do people see? What kind of light there was? What's going on in the atmosphere? I mean, there's just so many variables in every one of these, and I'll call them encounters, that it's just impossible to know. But one thing I think is clear, there's something going on that we don't understand.
And for those of you who followed Flight Safety Detectives for years, we've been talking about this off and on for 4 years. This is something that didn't just happen overnight. there was actually a very significant change in the U.S. government a few years ago where, for a variety of reasons, they adopted a new term, unidentified anomalous phenomena, to cover things that include what the common person knows as a UFO. And an unidentified anomalous phenomena could be an object, could be a weather phenomenon no one understands, could be something that you really can't describe. And in this particular case of the 767 being followed by what was characterized as drones, the FAA report described a vehicle that did a variety of things that drones don't usually do. For one, there are four of these traveling with the airliner for an hour. The airliner was traveling at about 420 knots ground speed. And to make a long story short, unless something is jet powered, it can't keep up that speed for that length of time at that altitude. Now, there are jet powered drones, including several models from the military, that conceivably could have done that. But I know of no acknowledged program where there are drones that are designed to fly essentially in formation with aircraft that are not connected to it electronically or otherwise. In other words, there's an aircraft out there, and four drones can fly around it for an hour. That would be a great thing to have if the military had that. I'm not aware of anything like that. And the other thing that didn't make sense, to do this sort of thing without getting permission from the FAA is so in violation of so many regulations, it's not funny. Any organization, military or civilian, that did this, and it was found out, they would have all sorts of sanctions and people would lose their jobs, etc. Now, another, getting back to the original question, why is it no longer called a UFO? Then and now, there's stigma around this subject. Even reporting this subject, there's stigma. One of the really interesting aspects of this report was you had an airliner crew who had unidentified aircraft in close proximity, as close as 1,000 feet, according to their report, for an hour. Yet they didn't pick up the radio and call air traffic control initially. They used a different system to, I believe, type out a message to their ground crew, one of their ground crews, I'm not sure which, so the FAA didn't specify it. The technology is called ACARS, which is commonly used by airliners around the world to send messages back and forth to operations on the ground, get updates on weather reports, that sort of thing. Somehow they typed out a message about these unidentified drones, got sent to the ground, then they contacted the FAA. Then the FAA broadcast a warning to all the aircraft in the area to be on the lookout for these objects that they described. And by the way, you're saying, how do you know it's a drone? Well, we don't. There was no description of what physical object was out there. There was a description of red and white flashing lights. And by the way, that's not a standard configuration for aircraft. At altitude, that altitude, the aircraft should have the standard configuration of lights, which would have red, green, and white, and various kinds of white lights, but a specific wingtip light that's red, a specific one that's green. And since they were in several positions around the aircraft, if there was a green light there, they should have seen that. So it begs the question, what kind of a drone was this? My answer is I don't know. The behavior of these lights was not extraordinary. It wasn't doing something that aircraft cannot do. But who was behind it, why they did it, and how much of a danger is it to aviation, I don't know. But there is a huge danger in not reporting things like this immediately. Imagine if there was an actual hazard to aircraft, yet this crew chose not to broadcast it where other pilots could hear. By the way, I'm going to run a video in the background for those of you who are watching the video version of this. I use a program called flystow.net that could basically run the clock back and answer the question, during a particular portion of flight, how many other aircraft crossed the flight path of this aircraft? And it was on the order of 10 or so airliners over the course of an hour that crossed in front of the reporting aircraft, either above or below their altitude. And my thought was, any one of these crossing aircraft could have been in danger of running into these four drones, whatever they were, that were circling this first aircraft. So it begs the question, if there's an apparent risk to aviation, why hesitate? You know, part of our job here is to just share what we know and just encourage the aviation professionals out there and anyone else who has information. If you see something like this, don't hesitate to call it out immediately. And again, yes, we understand. There's a lot of websites out there that constantly record air-to-air conversations and air-to-ground conversations, and they put the really juicy ones online. And yes, you could have a situation where you give this warning, and an hour later, your flight number, your airline, and your voice is out there for the entire internet to see. That's a risk, but it's also the reality we can't escape. So you have to weigh it in your mind. What's more important? Avoiding a little bit of potential personal embarrassment or making the system safer?
Well stated.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the best part of this job?
I would say just the amount of knowledge that I've been able to gather kind of about the GA industry in general. In the time that I've worked here, I feel like I've learned so much just from speaking with people on the phone, doing my everyday tasks in my job. We were able to do a ground school with a local CFI, which was super insightful. We went through the whole 9 hours. I felt like I've learned so much.
Have you had an opportunity to fly the simulator you have here in the office?
Yes, I flew, at least 2 hours, I think, and didn't crash, did some successful takeoffs and landings.
That's a good
the local pattern, so it was very cool to kind of get some insight into what our customers are doing, on a day-to-day basis, the training they're doing.
So with that knowledge, did that give you a better understanding when you're talking to a prospective client?
Absolutely.
What their needs are?
Yes. I feel a lot more confident speaking to people because I kind of understand where they're coming from, the types of aircraft they're discussing, the types of training that we're discussing in terms of, getting training discounts on there, asking, have you gotten your private certificate? Have you completed the ground school portion? What have you done? So that's been, I would say, very helpful.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
We have a little event to talk about today. Why don't you lead it off?
Well, this is an event switching gears. Well, we're not really switching gears because we're still talking about UAS aircraft, drones. In this case, it was a report of a drone crash, which happened in December of 2024. What was unusual about it is that you had two drones that were involved in a test flight in, Pendleton, Oregon. And they both shut their engines off or their motors off in midair, and they crashed. It turns out there was a software upgrade to these test aircraft. And the software upgrade had an error in it where the aircraft mistakenly thought they were at the proper height to shut their engines off. That it was in a landing configuration. It wasn't. It was some distance above the ground. I can't remember how many hundreds of feet it was. And they both crashed. All six motors of them shut down. The software fault was identified, and it's going to be fixed. But this really opened up a can of worms, because what's happening, and has been happening for a while, is that there are several companies out there, Amazon being one of them, that are very, very interested in using drones to deliver packages. In fact, Amazon's already doing this in two test locations in Texas and Arizona. And I suspect that should they be successful, they'll expand to a whole lot of other places. And more importantly, the FAA is already looking into the future, a future where you have autonomous drones basically sorting themselves out by talking to each other. Because if you have an urban area that has hundreds of drones flying, that's going to be literally way more drone aircraft flying than you have crewed aircraft. It's so many aircraft that they have to have a new system. They can't have air traffic control talking to some controller who is managing 100 drones at once. Let's be honest. One person can't automatically, figure out how to sort 100 drones at once, which is why there are systems that are going to be put in place where the drones are talking to one another and self-sorting and basically doing their own air traffic control at low altitude.
The FAA just put out a rule in this advance notice of rulemaking. So it doesn't mean the rule is going to be around the corner, but it means they are looking at it, and something is going to happen. So we're going to see drone delivery, routinely across the United States. And of course, they're not really very much, you're not going to see a lot of activity in Barking Spider, Montana, but you'll certainly see a lot of activity in New York, New Jersey area, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, the list goes on and on. Where delivering packages is just so expensive because you get your delivery vehicle stuck in traffic. And sometimes, you know, just recently, I'm in Florida right now. Just recently, there was a report on TV that there was a 2-hour wait getting out of the airport in Key West, Florida. You couldn't even get out of the airport. The traffic was so jammed up. And Key West is not a big city. So I never followed up and saw the reason. But 2 hours, you've got a delivery vehicle and they're going to delivering blood or medicine to somebody. That could be an issue. So we're going to see drones delivering goods, in the just next couple of years, and it will grow from there.
And it's not just something where the folks who are doing this want to do it because it's, you know, slick and advanced and all that sort of thing. There's a practical problem. In general, it's called the last mile problem. No matter what kind of transportation system you have, let's say you have an Amazon Prime Air jet going from one city to the other. Sure, the package is traveling at 500 miles an hour. Then it lands on the ground. You have to take it out of the airplane, put it on a truck. The truck's going at a particular speed. Well, let's say it's in a very congested urban area, downtown Manhattan. Even a truck might be stuck in traffic for an hour or so. But you can, instead of going, 1 mile an hour in downtown Manhattan, you stop just outside of Manhattan, put it on a drone, and boom, it's there in 5 minutes. So yeah, there are going to be customers who are going to want this. There'll be a need to do this in order to increase revenues and profits. So yeah, this is going to happen. But if it does happen, there's certain safety and reliability and other issues that come up that don't happen now with crewed aircraft. You can have a system failure on an aircraft, let's say a computer glitch or what have you. It will very likely affect one aircraft. Or this happened in the last year or so. There was a problem with a particular airline with their computer system for when it came to scheduling aircraft and crews. Well, until they figured out the problem, they just kept everything on the ground. But if you have 100 aircraft in the air at once, it's unlikely you'll have an airliner aircraft have a computer glitch that automatically affects all the aircraft and shuts the engines down, because you have people in the cockpit, you have procedures in place, and airliners are not designed so that the headquarters can push a button and stop everything. Now, when it comes to large-scale drone operations, you have technical malfunctions you can have, like sensor errors or software bugs, which was the case here. They can lead to crashes. You can have a loss or degradation of GPS signals. And by the way, Amazon is one of the companies that's pioneering the use of this. Another part of Amazon is also pioneering having an alternative to GPS called the Kuiper system. I don't know if they have long-term plans of using both GPS and Kuiper to navigate their drones, or they're just going to use Kuiper system. I'm not sure. But either one of those, either GPS, Kuiper, or all the other alternatives out there, can be spoofed, can be jammed, can have system failures. What happens when you have 100 drones flying and they suddenly don't have GPS-type signals to navigate? How are they going to navigate to a safe landing? Well, let's not even talk about people deliberately trying to hack into the system for whatever reason. It could be a state-level player, like some nation trying to attack another nation, or it could be a bunch of folks who have a beef with Amazon who are trying to take down all their drones at once. Who knows? But these sorts of things are not 100% going to be covered by whatever regulations the FAA comes up with, because it's a new technology. It is a new kind of normal flying that will happen a few years from now. And along the way, there are going to be things that the system and the industry discovers that they're not aware of now. Problems they'll uncover that they'll have to address. And we can only do what we can to prevent them ahead of time. And yes, I'm glad there are regulations out there. I'm glad they're not being allowed to just throw them out there by the hundreds. But there will be problems. Are there going to be problems that will bother people? I'll just leave you with this idea. Right now, the drone operations, commercial operations that are allowed in the U.S. on a wide scale is called Part 107 operations. And one of the limits is your drone can't fly higher than 100 knots in speed. Now, let's say you have a package delivery drone delivering a small package, 5 pounds, and it's traveling 100 knots. Let's say it's a fairly powerful drone, and the drone itself is 5 pounds. You have a 10-pound something zipping through the air at 100 miles an hour. If it has the same kind of problem that happened in Pendleton, Oregon, the engine, the motor stops, and it starts to fall, how much damage can something traveling 100 miles an hour at 10 pounds cause? I personally wouldn't want to be hit with one.
Yeah, me neither.
If anyone's watched the news in the last 3 years for what's happened in Ukraine, you can see just how quickly drone technology and drone procedures and techniques can evolve when there's a reason to make it evolve. Now, hopefully it won't be because of people shooting at each other, but I can easily foresee one or two companies having a sustainable competitive advantage because they're using drones. Others will follow. And whatever number of drones we think will be flying a few years from now, it will either be a whole lot more than that because it's a successful application, or a lot fewer because it doesn't have as much benefit as was first thought. And before we get to my next last word, I'd like to once again thank our sponsors for helping us to promote safety in the air. Learn about partnering with the Flight Safety Detectives at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. And my second to last word is the following. Thank you. Thank you for all of those who have sent in questions either by email or on our videos. Thank you for your continued interest in what we have to offer here. And please keep sending those questions in. Not only do we use them, but we can use them on the show, and you might hear your name or your handle in the future.
And for the last word, I certainly need to tell everybody again and again and again, if you're going to go flying, please do a good job of pre-planning your flight. Do it twice, once before you get to the airport and again at the airport. Make sure they agree. Make sure you check your weather, both where you are, where you're going, and everything in between. Reason why I say this on every show is all of our reviews of accidents and incidents, these issues keep coming up over and over and over. And in fact, we're going to be talking about a flight instructor who was actually pushing his student because he was taking too long to do a pre-flight. And that is absolutely crazy. You take as much time as you need to make sure your airplane is in flying condition. That's a pilot's responsibility. So, and after you do that and you get in the cockpit, make sure that you touch your airplane. Make sure that you pay attention. Taxiing. I can't tell you how many taxi mishaps that I have found. I'm keeping record of them. I'm into the second page. And those are very hard to find because they're not always reportable. You know, taxi into the fuel pump. I mean, people need fuel that bad. They got to taxi right into the fuel pump. It's amazing that we haven't had any big fires yet. Having said that, I bet we have one now. But anyway, taxi accidents on the ground, I just can't believe how many there are. Not paying attention, wingtip to wingtip. You know, it's just unbelievable. And after you get in the air, you got to keep that head on the swivel. We've had the number of close encounters is pretty high, and we have had a number of real maintenance accidents, not real accidents, with airplanes landing and taking off and colliding with one another. Not all of them crash, but there's damage, and those are also scary because they, by the grace of God, they could have been fatal, so those too. So we just have a lot of basic accidents the last couple of years. Just shake your head. We're supposed to be professional pilots. How do we get here? Anyway, we're going to talk more about that when I gather enough information to talk about it all. But until then, please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show.
We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Whether you're a student pilot, CFI, borrowing or building an airplane, or looking to buy, Avemco Insurance Company can help you find the right insurance coverage based on what you fly and how you fly it. No gotchas. No runaround. No confusing language. No middlemen. Avemco Insurance Company values safety and is a proud sponsor of the Flight Safety Detectives podcast. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety today. Earn an automatic 5% off by mentioning you're a Flight Safety Detectives listener.